Hey everyone, this is Ben Morton and welcome to another episode of the podcast that is brought to you in association with our sponsors, Friendworks, who provide a fantastic lead discovery tool. Please make sure you listen right to the very end of this episode to learn more about what they do and to access your exclusive discount code.
Luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity, and you got to be prepared. You really have to, no kidding, throughout your life, have a sense that you got to be ready for when that opportunity arrives so that you can truly make the most of it rather than watching it go by.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. This is Ben Morton, and a very warm welcome to episode 57 of the podcast. And what an episode it is. It is my absolute honour and privilege to be able to bring you this interview with General David Petraeus. General Petraeus is a partner with the global investment firm KKR and chairman of the KKR Global Institute, which he established in May 2013. He's also a member of the boards of directors of Optive and FirstStream. He's a venture investor in more than 15 startups and is engaged in a variety of academic endeavors. Prior to joining KKR, General Petraeus served over 37 years in the US military, culminating his career with 6 consecutive commands, 5 of which are in combat, including command of the 101st Airborne Division during the fight to Baghdad and the first year in Iraq, command of the Multinational Security Transition Command in Iraq, command of coalition forces in Iraq during the surge, command of US Central Command, and command of coalition forces in Afghanistan. Following retirement from the military, and after Senate confirmation by a vote of 94-0, he served as director of the CIA during a period of significant achievement in the global war on terror, the establishment of important agency digital initiatives, and significant investments in the agency's most important asset, its human capital. General Petraeus graduated with distinction from the US Military Academy, and he's the only person in US Army history to be the top graduate of both the demanding US Army Ranger School and the US Army's Command and General Staff College. For those of you who still want to know more about his background, we have included his full biography in the show notes for you. I have to say, folks, this really is a remarkable episode. And for sure, we've not had a guest on the show who has shouldered anywhere near the same weight of leadership responsibility as General Petraeus. In fact, during our conversation, I asked him directly how he remained resilient and managed this huge level of responsibility. Amongst this and other things, we discussed strategy, the big ideas, leadership styles, and how to get things done in highly complex, fast-moving environments. So everybody, without any further delay, please get yourselves comfy, grab a pen and paper, get ready to take loads of notes, and enjoy my incredible conversation with General David Petraeus. General, a very warm welcome to the podcast. It's fantastic to have you with us today, and thank you for making time. First of all, how are you today?
Doing great, man. Thanks. Just back from Europe, actually. My first overseas trip in a very long time.
Yeah, it's nice to get a sense that hopefully the world is starting to open up again.
Very much so.
General, can I ask with a new question I'm asking guests on the show, like, what does leadership mean to you?
Well, it's really pretty straightforward. It just means that, you know, the leader is the person from whom others take their lead in a whole variety of different ways in terms of the energy, their example, their determination, their big ideas. And we'll talk much more about that, their strategic judgment, because at the end of the day, what really differentiates the great leaders from other leaders, especially at the very top, is that issue of strategic judgment, of getting the big ideas right. But it's all these other factors. It's all the qualities and attributes and even sort of culture that a leader is seeking to establish, to instill, to develop in an organization. And of course, it varies from organization to organization. As a, you know, an air assault infantry battalion commander or airborne brigade commander, of course, this is a very physically fit, enormously, almost visceral, bring it on, jumping out of a plane in the middle of the night with 70 pounds of equipment or whatever on you. And so that culture is one of just physical and mental toughness, of determination, of ability to deal with hardship, to demonstrate initiative, small unit activities, and all the rest of that. And so the leader is the person at the end of the day who has to identify what the culture should be, what the big ideas should be, the areas of emphasis should be. And again, the qualities and attributes that individuals and the organization collectively aspire to demonstrate and to achieve. I work very hard, as an example, over the years to try to make every organization I was privileged to lead a learning organization, to make sure that we were constantly doing after action reviews after every operation, every exercise, every activity, basically. And you capture, okay, what should we have learned from this? What is it that we can do better next time? And how do we do that? How do we solidify the good elements of what took place? This is, again, that's what a leader really gets paid to do. And you have to be truly conscious of that. This is not something that is just sort of implicit or natural or takes place of its own accord. You have to be aware of what it is that you're trying to do, how you spend your time, what you communicate, what you see for yourself, how you measure, how you hire and fire and inspire and incentivize. All of this is all part of leadership. And we can talk perhaps in a moment about the four tasks that I think it's a good intellectual architecture for leadership, and particularly, if you will, for strategic leadership, the leadership at the very top of an organization, which can, of course, be everything from a handful of people in a startup where the founder and CEO is a strategic leader because he or she has to get the big ideas right, communicate them effectively, oversee their implementation, and then determine how to refine them and do it again and again and again. But the same is true of the individual who's leading the surge in Iraq with, you know, nearly 200,000 U.S. and coalition forces and in a vast organization in which you're still, you got to get the big ideas right. You got to get the strategy right. You have to figure out how to communicate the elements of that throughout the breadth and depth of the organization. Then you have to oversee its implementation. And by the way, in something like that, you're driving a campaign plan. Make no mistake about it. You may try to make it look easy. You may try to make it look as if you have a light hand on the reins. But the truth is, you have to drive it. And then, of course, you can't overlook that final task, which is to determine how to refine the big ideas so that you can do it again and again and again. And the great strategic leaders, Reed Hastings at Netflix, Jeff Bezos, Jack Ma, all of these, if you measure them against those four tasks, you'll see why it is they're so outstanding.
General, you touched on some of the leadership roles you've had. So you've had an incredible and highly distinguished career yourself. What would you say are one or two of the biggest leadership lessons you've learned, either through experience or maybe that someone early on was fortunate to share with you that have really stayed with you?
Well, first of all, I think you just have to acknowledge that leadership development, including your own leader development, is a function of three different types of endeavors. One is some formal education. You know, you actually, especially in the military, you go through leader development education. You're constantly, you know, you have a pre-commissioning, you go to West Point or Reserve Officer Training Corps, you have a basic course, basic officer leader course. You go out into the Army, work for a few years, you go to the advanced course, few years, staff college, war college. So these are actual formal courses, some part of which will actually feature leadership development. And that's important. That's the formal education. Then there is the the self-education, if you will, the reading, the development. And I was I'm still a huge reader, voracious reader of biographies, learning about how others led, particularly in your own profession, but not limited to that. But as I was growing in the military, reading about those who came before me. And in fact, we used to say we stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. And I wanted to know something about the individuals whose shoulders we were standing on, and read again a great deal about them, and tried to learn from their successes, their failures, their mistakes, their achievements. And then, of course, there is the actual doing. It's the actual assignments, particularly those when you are in a leadership assignment. So a platoon leader, a company commander, battalion, brigade, division, you know, on up to commander of multinational force in Iraq and the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. But also actually when you're not in charge. And I was privileged on a number of occasions to be, for example, the aide to the chief of staff of the Army, the speechwriter for the special assistant for the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, the executive officer for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs for 2 years. I mean, these are what we call vantage point jobs. You're chosen for those, frankly, not through politics or because you're good at golf or you can make a good martini. You're chosen because you generally work hard, have a head on your shoulders, can help them figure out what they want to communicate and then how to communicate. And orchestrate and oversee usually ever bigger and bigger offices. I mean, the office of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs was a couple hundred people, as I recall. So you're also managing that office, overseeing it, while also, again, orchestrating everything that that chairman is doing with a great team of schedulers and aides and everything else to help you. So those are very important. And I think you have to be conscious of those three elements of leader development. But beyond that, if you ask me the big two takeaways, one is somewhat individual, but it's the idea that you really don't get a trophy just for showing up. Life is a competitive endeavor. It's not little kids soccer where you get a t-shirt just for, you know, showing up for the game, or even our son brought home a trophy. I thought, wow, we won the championship. Actually, they didn't. It's just everybody got a trophy. Well, the real world's not like that. You don't get a trophy unless you actually are number one. But there's a huge caveat here. You not only want to be number one, you also want to be, so not just the best individually, you also want to be the best team player in the world. And so when we were doing the fight to Baghdad, when I was a two-star general commander of the great 101st Airborne Division, you know, we really, for our historical purposes, we wanted to air assault into history and take Baghdad International Airport. But I realized, you know, early on that the most important contribution we could make to the entire campaign was actually to provide support for the armored and mechanized division that was to our front. And so we pushed our 72 Apache helicopters out in front of them and vacuumed up the enemy to the extent that we could. When he asked me if I had any ammunition to spare of a certain type of artillery, I just sent him the entire artillery unit. I said, what else do you need? He said, how about an infantry battalion? We air assaulted my old battalion, in fact, right to where he wanted it. Again, we needed to be a team player, not just out for the individual glory of the great 101st Airborne Division. So that's hugely important. The other big lesson, I think, is that luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. Let me explain this. I mean, a lot of people have said, well, General Petraeus got lucky time after time. You know, he just happens to command the 101st when they're doing the fight to Baghdad. And he just happens to, then they go to Mosul and they sort of get it right. And so that brings him back and it just keeps sort of going. And then all of a sudden he's back in the States and they do a counterinsurgency field manual and overhaul all the preparation of forces and leaders and equipment, everything for Iraq. But Iraq is going downhill fast. It's on the verge of a civil war. They're desperate. So the president calls Petraeus off the bench again, and puts him in command. But I mean, he's going to give him 25,000 additional forces and a complete free reign. How lucky is that? You know, as if anybody could have done it. But the truth is that in some respects, and I don't want this to sound lacking humility or something, but I've been preparing my entire life for that moment. And we went in, and the surge that mattered most in Iraq wasn't the surge of forces. It was the surge of ideas. It was the change in strategy that was literally 180 degrees from what we'd been doing before, and actually 180 degrees from what the Prime Minister of Iraq wanted to continue to do. But we recognized that we had to reverse the process of getting out of the neighborhoods and consolidating on big bases to go home. And we had to go back into the neighborhoods. We had to secure the people, and we could only do it by living with them, as we put it, together with our Iraqi counterparts, but that we had to take back over control of security from our Iraqi counterparts because they'd been so battered and beaten up and basically rendered militarily incapable of accomplishing their mission. So this is a massive change. You know, this is 77 additional locations just in the Baghdad area that we had to fight to establish. And then on top of that, we recognize that you can't kill or capture your way out of an industrial strength insurgency. You have to reconcile with as many of the rank and file of the insurgents and the Shia militia as you possibly can. And we reconciled with about 103,000 over time, even as we also intensified the hunt, the manhunt, basically, for the irreconcilables, the leaders of al-Qaeda in Iraq, of the major Sunni insurgent groups and of the major Iranian-supported Shia militia elements. And again, there's much more. There was also a greater civil military integration, comprehensive approach, a true civil military campaign plan signed by both the ambassador and me, and on and on. But again, I'd sort of prepared my entire life for that moment, had just distilled all that we should have learned to that point in a counterinsurgency field manual, and now you actually get to implement it. And so again, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity, and you got to be prepared. You really have to, no kidding, throughout your life, have a sense that you got to be ready for when that opportunity arrives so that you can truly make the most of it rather than watching it go by.
General, I'd love, if it's okay, to ask you a question off of the ones we spoke about in advance, which is, when you was leading that surge and leading that complete 180 change in direction that you spoke about, how did you personally go about sort of shouldering the weight of that responsibility and really have the confidence and courage of conviction to drive that through? Because that's a level of decision-making and leadership that most of us just cannot wrap our heads around.
No, and look, somebody asked me to describe what it was like commanding the surge in Iraq, and this is after it had succeeded, and everybody, even its fiercest critics all said, you know what, actually, we may have questioned it, but, you know, when violence is down by 85% in 18 months and it stays down for 3.5 years, maybe that actually did work. My response to the individual who said, you know, what was it like? I said, you know, it was the most awesomely awesome experience on a good day, but there were less than this many good days. This is the fingers of one hand in the 19 and a half months that I was privileged to command the surge. Because the truth is, it was a grinding experience. That was particularly true the first 6 months, because as I told Congress before going back over, I said, it's going to get much worse before it gets better, because we must go back into the neighborhoods that are now controlled by the insurgents, al-Qaeda, and Iranian-supported Shia militia. We are going to have to separate these forces. We're going to have to clear them from areas, hold those areas, rebuild those areas, and very slowly transition control back to the Iraqi security forces. And the casualties are going to grow initially. Happily, the civilian casualties started going down right away. Suicide bombings went down right. You know, we actually established some real achievements in the first probably 3 months that were becoming irrefutable. But our own casualties, the number of attacks per day, all of this was going up to the highest levels ever. And I told Congress that, but I still was keenly aware that at the six-month mark, I had agreed during the confirmation hearing, I had to agree, they made me, that I would come back at 6 months and testify to them. And I did with Ambassador Ryan Crocker, the greatest diplomatic partner any soldier ever had. And it was a really, really tough experience. It was very, very emotional. A lot of the people that were interrogating us basically in these hearings, questioning us, were running for president. So they're trying to make points on you. We had established by that point in time very clear achievements. It was no longer, you know, just a quirk. It was truly statistically undeniable that we were driving violence down. I think it was down by 40 or 50% by that point in time, which was an enormous achievement after years of it just getting worse and worse and worse and being on the verge of a full-blown Sunni-Shia civil war. That doesn't mean, though, that, again, it was not a really, really tough experience. And I mean, and we were being personally criticized, not just professionally. I opened the New York Times. We were rifling through. This is when you still had real papers to go through and make sure that my public affairs guys and everybody's rifling through these papers to make sure there's nothing that will sort of blow up, you know, the morning of the hearing as we're getting ready to go to Capitol Hill. And I open in the center two page is a criticism of me personally. Again, not the policy. And actually, they made a mistake with that. They went too far and it gave the supporters of the surge something to be outraged about. And it was a really foolish move, as it turned out. But people then asked me, you know, what did you feel like? The ambassador and I went to the National Press Club, you know, big deal, press conference at the end of these two grueling days of hearings. And they said, well, General, you know, how did it feel to open the New York Times and see a two-page ad attacking you personally? And, you know, I responded by saying that obviously I didn't exactly stand up and applaud, but I actually, on reflection, am proud to wear the uniform of a country and to defend the rights of my fellow citizens to criticize me and to exercise freedom of the press and these other freedoms and ideals that we're so proud to uphold. So again, it was a grind. I was very fortunate in a way to be reading a book called Grant Takes Command. It just happened, a military historian at my previous assignment in the US gave it to me a day or two before I left. I didn't think much of it. We threw it in a rucksack. It somehow ends up on this little table by my bunk. I start going through it at night. And, you know, it was, you're so tired. You're so at the edge of your physical capability that you fall asleep every night and the book falls on the floor. I mean, it's not that you're getting a few pages, but as I got into it and I realized, and I'm not trying to make the surge in Iraq the U.S. Civil War in any way, but what Grant went through and the sheer determination that he had to demonstrate, the casualties, the political second guessing, the constant, you know, criticism of this or that, his own leaders sometimes undermining him really, really hard. And the approach that he had, this indomitable will, quiet will, best exemplified by the end of the first day of the bloody Battle of Shiloh, where Sherman, his most trusted lieutenant, comes out of the dark and says, you know, they'd almost been driven back into the Tennessee River. They're clinging to the riverbank. Basically, there's casualties crying all around them. The seriously wounded are having limbs amputated. And Sherman comes out of the dark and he says, well, Grant, we had the devil's own day today, didn't we? And Grant takes a cigar out of his mouth and he says, yep, lick him tomorrow, though. And, you know, reading that actually was hugely inspirational to me. It's just serendipity that this book ends up in that rucksack, ends up on that table, and you start reading it and you find inspiration.
Serendipity, or maybe it's where preparation meets opportunity.
It could be that, too.
In general, it's a nice lead-in to something else I wanted to ask you. So when you were leading coalition forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, with so many, what I can imagine must have been so many demands upon your time, and in such a complex, fast-paced, changing VUCA, to use that phrase, environment, how did you, on a quite practical level, find the time to sort of step back from that detail and keep an eye on the big ideas and the strategic imperatives?
Well, there are a number of different ways that you do that. First of all, you put it onto your battle rhythm. You make it part of what you have to do. You create action forcing mechanisms for yourself. We had a huge butcher box piece of paper, which had what we did every single day of the week. You know, there are some things we did every day because you're in combat. It's 7 days a week. Then there are some things that you do a few times a week, such as go out after the morning update and the morning this and that, the intel and so forth. You would get immediately in a vehicle or a helicopter or a plane and go out and find a unit and go on a patrol with it, experience it, feel it for yourself. You have actions that took place once a week, you know, certain video conferences with Washington or this or that, or meetings with the president of Afghanistan or the prime minister of Iraq, all of this. So you have this battle rhythm. But on there, we had action forcing mechanisms. And one of those, for example, in both Iraq and Afghanistan was that I met with the strategic plans team once a week. And that forced me, and their idea, you know, this, their charge, their mission was to force me to make decisions. And the truth is that when you are ground down the way that we were, right at the edge of your physical existence, the weather is often fairly extreme, particularly in the case of Baghdad, where it could be 120 degrees in the afternoon with a 25 to 35 knot wind blowing dust at you. So you have to force yourself to do this. And we had a number of those. And then, you know, you meet every single week with the guy who's doing the train and equip mission. But, you know, one week you look at the Army, the next week you look at the police, the next you look. And so you, even there's a rhythm within those kinds of actions. And then it went all the way on up to the monthly meeting that I had. We had lessons learned teams all over the battlefield from the Army, the Marine Corps, Special Operations, Asymmetric Warfare Group, my Counterinsurgency Center, et cetera. And they would all get an hour of my time once a month. And the chief of staff of the organization would facilitate the process to where they'd sit down with me and say, here are lessons that we believe need to be learned. They aren't learned yet. They're only learned when you actually incorporate them in that first task, the big ideas, getting the big ideas right. Then you communicate them by the change in the mission statement of the campaign plan or your guidance, SOPs, print, whatever. I publish counterinsurgency guidance personally in each of those wars, and I'd hit the send key every month or two, every time I had a new sort of little tweak to it. And then the overseeing the implementation of the big ideas, and then that fourth task again, determining how to refine them, which is what is part of this. Then beyond that, every quarter we would have a big review of the campaign, painful as all get out, endless slides, all the ambassadors, all of our counterparts, all the generals, people would come from Washington and London and Central Command headquarters and so forth. But then also back to the daily, we always found time for physical fitness. So even in Iraq, where, you know, I'd get up at maybe 5:30, guy would hand me a cup of coffee, I'd get the intel book, I'd go through very quickly through some classified email, then I'd get on a stationary bike and I'd just be leafing through the overnight intel book and making notes for myself. Because this is, again, I'm by myself. There's nobody talking to me. There's no, and you know, so you pedal for 45 minutes or something like that, and then do some strength and flexibility quickly, have a quick bite to eat, and you're in your seat in the command post at 7:30 for the morning update, which takes an hour, and it had its own rhythm. Certain stuff you'd get every single day, you know, the number of attacks, casualties, all the rest of this major operations. But then maybe once a week, you'd look at electricity production, once a week in Iraq, oil production. And again, a whole series of these that are all embedded in what is a pretty well-developed, very, very well-developed set of briefings, meetings, activities, all of which, again, are designed to both enable you and in some cases to force you to make the decisions and give the guidance necessary to drive that campaign plan forward.
I can only imagine, General, the value you must have taken from that 45 to an hour period where you was by yourself on the stationary bike, just in terms of processing.
It was hugely important. Yep. And we would run as well, by the way. In Iraq, I think we could only do it 3 days a week just because of the sheer demands. But I mean, I was getting the morning sort of maintenance workout in, but then three times a week, we would actually have runs. And because of the schedule, you really could only do it in the late afternoon. And it was really, really pretty grim during the summer months in particular. Some of those times we would actually bring people in so that I could multitask, and we would bring in, I was a pretty decent runner even then. And so we would have to get people that were usually captains or majors who could keep up. We didn't have, there was only one general, I think, in the entire theater who dared to run with me, but we would bring them in and it would be not just a run. And we would usually run actually a 10K. We had there was an old artificial lake, huge artificial lake that Saddam had conveniently built in a compound that we took over, where we had our headquarters and a lot of our facilities. And we would usually run, I think it was 3 or 4 miles sort of together. We might call it a talking pace, but it's pretty brisk. And then the final 2 miles, it was, you know, everybody for himself. And sadly, I had an aide and one security guy who could regularly beat me, but it was probably good for my ego. But we would also, during those times, sometimes I would say, I don't want anybody today. I just want to think on the run. And people knew just don't, you know, we had a team that would all, because you got a whole bunch of people that would all be engaged in this. But those are really helpful. I actually used to run with the ambassador. We would bring him over every Sunday morning by helicopter from the embassy in downtown Baghdad. And he and I would run together and talk about, you know, the week that was and the week that was coming up. So you have to build all this in. And that was really the key, was recognizing that, you know, this is my calendar. I'm going to get exercised. I will be cross if you guys don't execute what it is that we've agreed to here. But this is serious. I am not joking around when I say I want to do this, 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 and this. You guys better figure out how to do it, or again, I'll be exercised.
Yeah. And Jeremy, that's a lovely lead-in. I saw a video online where I think you said you'd once been asked to describe your leadership style. And I think your response was along the lines of, well, it depends. Can you tell us a little?
Yeah, it does. I was always, you know, this is something that sort of came to me later on. You know, people are curious about what is that style? You know, are you, I don't know, firm but fair, or you're, you know, again, as if it is one style for all. And what I realized over time was it's not one style for all. I will describe what leadership style I exhibit if you explain to me what leadership style is required to bring out the best individually in each of those who report to me directly and in the organization collectively. Because organization, I mean, leading the CIA is vastly different from being a second lieutenant airborne ranger leading into an airborne platoon. I mean, again, it doesn't get much more physical and visceral and let's do this thing, follow me and do as I do. Whereas obviously at the other end of the spectrum, you've got to be equal parts, both cerebral, inspirational, thoughtful, steady, et cetera. So everyone, I think, does respond differently. I have found that I often respond to people that pat you on the back, I guess, or applaud you or inspire you. When I was a captain, I had a brigade commander. I was quite a good runner at that point in time, but I was not a national class runner. But we would go to some races on Saturday or Sunday mornings in some of the bigger cities in the Southeast. And this guy would have me believing that I could stay with the guy who had just, you know, won the national collegiate champion or something like that. And I knew that was just crazy. But those kind of people brought the best out in me. Those that challenge you, that say, hey, you think you can do, or let me see you do this. Or let's, you know, have you ever thought about trying for this particular award? I mean, that company that I was privileged to command achieved something that no other company in the entire division had ever achieved in history. It's called the Expert Infantry Company Distinction. And it was very, very rigorous and competitive and everything else. But, you know, we did it. Brigade commander said, hey, you going to have a basketball team this year? I mean, I'm not a basketball player. I did play. But so I decided I'll coach him. And lo and behold, I mean, we won the basketball championship. And again, you can do this stuff. When I was a battalion commander, there was almost nothing that we really didn't. We were at the very least in the very top two or three. But I mean, there were certain cross country we won every year, football every year, basketball, I think, you name it. And it's because people sort of challenged us, applauded us, gave us energy. And so, again, you have to determine, is this an individual who needs a pat on the back once a year, or an individual who needs really direct guidance and real careful oversight? And I was privileged to lead individuals of both types. There were some, when I was a two-star brigade commanders, to whom counterinsurgency just came naturally. It's very different because you're not just going out trying to kill or capture bad guys. You're actually after you achieve security, you solidify the security by improving basic services for the people, by rebuilding damaged infrastructure, by reestablishing local grievance mechanism, by, you know, all of this. It's all of that softer side of stuff that actually solidifies what it is that you have achieved on the security front. Some people took to that very naturally. Others did not want to touch it. And so those that didn't want to touch it, we had to determine how it was that they were going to understand that it was really important. And, you know, ultimately the word went out that they were going to brief me in 2 weeks on their counterinsurgency campaign plan. A lot of people would spend time with them prior to my arrival. And by the time I got there, they got it. So I think that's the key when it comes to this whole notion of what one's leadership style is.
I think that leads really nicely into, I think it was on the same video that I watched, I heard you speak, General, about sometimes people describe in there as being two Petraeuses. And the bit around that I'm really fascinated by. So I had a brief career in the military myself. And one thing that has stayed with me is the concept of mission command, or to give it more civilian speak, freedom within a framework. But I was really intrigued to hear you speak about on the how sometimes you would really focus on mission command. And then at other times you would have to really focus on much more directly imposing your will and driving the plan. So can you tell us just a little about that in the time we have?
Yeah. I mean, in an ideal situation, you have individuals who are very, very capable, have all the professional skills, knowledge, attributes, and experience and expertise. And they're the ones that you can essentially, you give some general guidance, light hand on the reins, and they're the ones who will say, in the absence of orders, figure out what they should have been and execute aggressively. And they will do that. Then there are other situations, especially sometimes when you're doing something that's really quite different. And the truth is, in the beginning in Iraq, again, we trained for combat. I was one of the very few, our division was the only division really that did the fight to Baghdad and then stayed and did what was becoming pretty rapidly a counterinsurgency, counterterrorism campaign, not conventional combat. So we fought a conventional fight. And, you know, if you have a problem in a conventional fight, you blow it up. You know, you drop 40 bombs on a city the morning before you attack it and all the rest of that. Precision, by the way, I would add, and then very precise use of attack helicopters and close air support and so forth. But later on, then we're doing this very uncomfortable stuff. And actually, except for a lot of us, thankfully, you know, I'd served in Haiti. I was the United Nations chief of operations in Haiti, not the U.S. We had the U.S. under us, but I was actually a blue beret purely, not a dual headed. I spent a year in Bosnia doing a combination of, again, the operations chief for the stabilization force there, but also the war criminal hunt and counterterrorism operations after 9/11 as well. So a lot of us had the background that this came somewhat naturally, but not in all cases. We had a number of battalion commanders in particular, a few of them, who didn't just naturally seem to get this. And so again, it took a little bit more in those cases. But you had certain commanders to whom you had to provide very, very little in the way of guidance. And then others, we recognized that we had to provide a good bit more definition and specificity to them. But that's, again, part of, I think, being an effective leader. I think the idea, the notion that you're always just going to be able to give this sort of vague guidance and mission command and everybody's going to, you know, define it and determine it and come to the same conclusion and all march in the same direction, that's probably a bit fantastical.
And General, one final very quick fire question, if we may. What would you say is the one book that has really had the greatest impact upon you?
Well, you know, I mentioned it earlier, this book by Bruce Catton, Grant Takes Command, which is an old classic book about Grant in the Civil War. And, you know, he really was the individual at the end of the day. In fact, a book title was this, The Man Who Saved the Union. And he did that because after a number of failing generals could not deal with Robert E. Lee and had to be replaced, they finally bring Grant east from the Western Front. He crafts for the first time a truly comprehensive strategy, gets the big ideas right. He was really good at that. He could see space and time and geography in his mind. And then he communicated it effectively, second task. He then oversaw the implementation of the campaign plan, sat in the back pocket of the main effort going after Lee, and then constantly was refining it, determining how to refine the big ideas and do it again. And the result of this campaign plan is several major victories, particularly Sherman at Atlanta and then McClellan in the Shenandoah Valley and some others, that finally convinced the citizens of the Union, who were, you know, having draft riots and about to say, let's end this thing, this is not worth it. And so that won the election of 1864, re-election of Abraham Lincoln, and that did save the Union, because had Lincoln's opponent won, General McClellan, of all things, who had twice failed as the Union leader, he would have sued for peace and you would not have the Union that we have today. So Grant, again, his importance cannot be overstated, even though he was a very modest, unassuming, didn't wear uniforms that were particularly resplendent, humble, quiet individual, his achievement was really extraordinary. And again, it was in reading about him during the toughest endeavor of my life, which was the surge, and particularly the first 6 months of the surge, that I drew inspiration. And I think that's what all of us can find in reading about others. I mean, I've loved reading about Churchill endlessly, for example, and Andrew Roberts' recent biography, I think, is the single best single volume of that, but others as well. You know, Wellington, obviously all the famous American generals and leaders over the years. And again, it's this, that component, I think, of our self-development, of our understanding of leadership and the qualities and attributes you have to bring to it, that really make a big difference down the road and can validate my proposition that luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity.
And what a wonderful place to finish up and draw things to a close. General, it's been an absolute privilege chatting to you today. On behalf of everybody listening and myself, thank you for being so generous with your time, knowledge and wisdom. I'm sure everybody listening will take great value from it. So thank you very much indeed.
No, the privilege is mine, Ben. Lead on.
I hope you found that conversation valuable, folks, but most importantly, I really hope that you're able to go away and make some small positive changes as a result. If you did get value from this episode, then please do rate, review and subscribe via iTunes, as it really does enable us to keep bringing you more and more interviews with fantastic leaders and subject matter experts. Do also visit ben-morton.com, where you can connect with me, find out more about my leadership mentoring and team development work, along with details of all of my online programs via the tools and resources page. That's it for this episode. See you again in the next one very soon, and lead on. Before you go, folks, please let me tell you a little bit more about Friendworks, our sponsor. Friendworks is a lead discovery tool that I've been using in my business for some time now. Its premise is very simple. Your professional networks are always changing. In fact, research suggests that around 23% of your professional network could change roles every single year. And you probably realize that a large percentage of your business opportunities comes from those networks. But how do you keep a tab on not only your own networks, but those of your entire business? You probably have silos within your business of people who do this monitoring very effectively. But I bet that work isn't standardized, and I bet it happens infrequently. What this means is that you could be missing out on lots of business opportunities. Friendworks helps to minimize this risk by monitoring your professional networks for you. Get a 5% discount on the cost of Friendworks by quoting the code BenMorton5. And to quantify how Friendworks could help your business, they have a really cool lead calculator tool on their website. So do please check them out via their website at www.friend-works.com. That link and discount code is also in the show notes for you. That's it for this episode, folks. Once again, take care, look after yourselves, and lead on.